Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. This hour, we're going to hear about California Assembly Bill 56. This new legislative proposal would require warning labels on social media platforms to inform users about the potential mental health risks for young people. And then Oakland is grappling with a $129 million budget deficit and uncertainty over its leadership following a successful mayoral recall effort. We'll break down what's at stake for the city's future given these dual crises. We'll be joined by Shomik Mukherjee from the Bay Area News Group. And finally, later on this hour, if you're looking to spark some holiday cheer, well, we've got you. Later in the hour, we're going to whisk you off to San Francisco's Great Dickens Christmas Fair, where it's perpetually Christmas Eve in Victorian London. All that's ahead. But first, in the age of constant scrolling and endless notifications, the mental health of young people is increasingly at the forefront of public health concern. California is taking bold steps to address this with AB 56, a proposed law that would require social media platforms to display warning labels that highlight the risks that these apps can pose to mental health and well-being, particularly for teens and children. Now, while proponents say that the legislation is a vital step to educate and protect families, critics are raising questions about its feasibility and effectiveness. So we're going to get into all of those questions. So tonight we're joined by three experts, including the bill author. First, I want to welcome Dr. Jean Twenge, psychologist and author of several books, including iGen, Why Today's Super Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood, and what that means for the rest of us. Jean has spent several years researching the relationship between technology and generational mental health trends. Welcome back to State of the Bay, Jean.
Thank you.
And we're also going to hear from Jim Steyer, Stanford professor and founder and CEO of Common Sense Media. Jim is also the author of several books, including Which Side of History? How Technology is Reshaping Democracy and Our Lives. Welcome back to State of the Bay to you, Jim.
Great to be here. Thanks.
And finally, we're joined by Democratic Assembly member from the Bay Area here in Orinda, Rebecca Bauer Cahan, who introduced AB 56 and is advocating for its passage in the state legislature. Welcome back to State of the Bay, Rebecca.
Thanks for having this important conversation. Happy to be here.
Absolutely. Well, not only are we going to talk to all three of you, we want to hear from you, our listeners. So State of the Bay listeners, we're going to open up the phone lines early tonight to hear from you. Have you noticed the effects of social media on your children or family? Do you think warning labels on these apps could make a difference in how they're used? You can give us a call as we open the phone lines now. We're at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us with any questions at stateofthebay@kalw.org. And finally, just before we begin, I just want to note that this conversation will include mentions of suicide. And if you or anyone you know is struggling, I want you to know that help is available. You can call or text the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988. That's 988. Well, Dr. Jean Twenge, let's begin with you. Can you just walk us through what the research has uncovered about the connection between social media and the mental health of young people?
Well, for one thing, teen depression doubled between 2011 and 2019, so well before the pandemic. But that happens to be right at the time that social media became popular among teens. It went from kind of optional to virtually mandatory. It also changed in its character. The algorithms that keep people hooked got much more sophisticated. 2012 is also around the time that Facebook bought Instagram. Then we have at the individual level that the more hours a day a teen spends using social media, the more likely it is he or she is depressed. And in several studies, that's not a small effect. The heavy users are about twice as likely to be depressed as lighter users. Then we know from several experimental studies that can show causation that when people give up or cut back on social media, you look at them a few weeks later, they are happier than less depressed than the group that continued their normal social media use.
So, Gene, in your opinion, are there something about the features of these platforms, that, like the infinite scrolling or these algorithmic recommendations, that's contributing to these issues specifically?
There's so many mechanisms, and that's one reason I am happy to see this bill and other attention paid to this issue. Because for one thing, Gallup concluded last year that teens spend an average of almost 5 hours a day using social media. So that's interfering with their face-to-face social time with each other, with sleep, with all kinds of other things that are better for mental health. Then there's the mechanisms you mentioned of infinite scroll, the algorithms, which are so sticky and so it makes it so hard to close the app and so hard to stay away from it. Because, of course, the longer teens spend on the app, the more money the companies make. And then there's the body image issues, the appearance issues, particularly for girls and young women. There's cyberbullying. There's unknown adults being able to contact minors. And keep in mind, age isn't verified and parental permission is not required. So it's pretty routine for 9 and 10-year-olds to be on social media, even though nobody wants that.
So Assemblymember Rebecca Bauer-Cahan, let's go to you. I want to talk about the bill that you just introduced, Assembly Bill 56. Why did you think it was important for California to introduce this legislation now?
You know, I think that we have been working incredibly hard to lead as California in protecting our children. I think it is the responsibility that is greatest for us as lawmakers. And so we have done a lot to try to help improve the situation that you just heard from Dr. Twing about how this is harming our children. And much of that is caught up in the courts. And so this is a real shift to what the Surgeon General is focused on, which is a public awareness campaign. You know, parents, I think I am a parent of teens myself, we know that it isn't great for our kids. We see it firsthand, but I think we need to do more to get parents to understand that the studies show that more than 3 hours of usage is harmful to our kids' mental health. And so we really thought by ensuring that these warnings are put in place, that you are told when you log in that this is the case, and you continue to be told as you reach these critical timelines, that it would help raise awareness and get kids off of social media and back out into community with their friends.
Yeah, and Assemblymember Bauer-Cahan, can you just talk about how that works in practice? What do these warning labels look like, when and how would they be displayed to users?
Yeah, so we're finalizing what that will look like. And I think we really are leaning on the research. You know, we are benefiting from all of the great work of, you know, Dr. Twing and her colleagues who have looked into when children start to experience these mental health impacts. And so we really want to make sure that they get this information when they log on, when they start to utilize social media. And then at 3 hours, when we know they're starting to have those negative mental health impacts, that they are reminded again, that they are continually reminded that they've now passed that point, that it is healthy for them to be using social media. And, you know, this is something we've done successfully in other health areas such as smoking. And so we need to really lean into the public health impact of this and do what is necessary for our kids.
And so far on this bill, just briefly, have any groups lined up in support or in opposition? What are you hearing from the sort of interest groups out there on the kinds of issues?
Well, we're so lucky to have Jim Steyer here with us because, of course, Common Sense Media, whose entire mission is to protect our kids online, are our strongest and greatest supporters, in addition to my sponsor of the bill, which is Attorney General Bonta. So we are moving forward with those folks, but we are seeing others excited to join us in protecting kids' health.
All right. Well, with that segue, let's go to Jim Steyer. I want to bring you into the conversation. Can you talk about what social media companies are doing now in response to pressure like this to make their platform safer for teens?
Well, it's a good question. And by the way, thank you, Rebecca, for your kind words, and Gene for all the good work you do. So it's a pleasure to be on with two outstanding women like this. I would tell you that it just depends on the company. And so some are worse actors than others, but some of the broader trends that Gene outlined and that Rebecca underscored are there, period, full stop. I think this is sort of like a tobacco moment for the social media industry, the Instagrams, the Facebooks of the world, because they've had an incredible impact on society and made an incredible amount of money. But as Gene outlined and then Rebecca underscored, they've also created an incredible amount of problems and harm for young people, and actually for, I think, more than just young people in our society. So I think some have been much more responsible than others, but this is a really good public awareness campaign, as Rebecca said, which will educate the public and moms and dads and kids themselves, which I think is critical, about the stuff we're talking about. And it's simple and easy to understand, and it'll pass. And I think it's part of the broader campaign we just have to run now to, as Rebecca said, take care of kids and families everywhere.
And Rebecca, go back to you on this legislation. What are the specific outcomes that you hope that this legislation might achieve?
You know, I hope that we will move to a society closer to the one I grew up in, to be honest with you. I grew up before social media. And, you know, my interactions with my peers were direct, right? Telephone calls and really relational positive interactions. Not all positive. Junior high isn't easy for everybody. But generally speaking, you know, I was having healthy interactions that were challenging and allowing me to grow. And we're seeing that as we keep kids online on these social media platforms, they're missing out on those growth opportunities. And so I do hope that we will see happen what happened in my youth with tobacco, where we didn't know the harms. And all of a sudden there was this kickstarted public health campaign where we really started to think about smoking differently. And youth in my generation just didn't pick up that habit the way prior generations had, because we all of a sudden understood that it was harmful to our health in a real and meaningful way. And so that's my hope, is that we will start to get the public to understand that this incredible constant usage, 5 hours a day on average for kids, of social media is harmful to their health, and we need to shift our behavior and get our kids healthy, happy, and engaged again.
And Rebecca, I note that California has taken a number of steps to try to hold social media companies accountable. There have been, as I understand it, some recent enforcement actions against TikTok and Meta. Can you talk about those efforts and how AB 56 could fit into that broader picture of regulating the tech industry and protecting young users in particular?
Absolutely. You know, other incredible women from the Bay Area have done great work in this space. Senator Skinner had a bill that she did with Common Sense Media last year focused on the addictive features of these platforms. Assemblymember Wicks from Oakland also did an incredible bill on age-appropriate design. Both of those, the social media companies are fighting in court right now. So we are waiting to see if those will go into effect to protect our kids. But, you know, all of these really could work together, right? If we were able to have age-appropriate design for our kids when they go online, if we were to protect them from the addictive features, and then we were to have a public awareness campaign that got them to understand the impact of usage beyond 3 hours, I think all of that would make our kids healthier and happier. So I think we are going in the right direction of using all the tools in our toolbox to protect our kids. And you mentioned some of the lawsuits that our incredible Attorney General Bonta has brought against these social media platforms. And those are also critical. You know, what TikTok is doing by keeping our kids online and using their private data in ways that are in violation of California law are important things that we need our top law enforcement officer, Attorney General Bonta, ensuring we are protected from.
Well, let's go to the phone lines now. As I mentioned, we were opening them up early, and we've got Rick from Citrus Heights dialing in. Rick, welcome to State of the Bay.
Hey, good to talk to you guys again. Rebecca Bauer-Cahan, you might have heard of me in conversations. I live up here in Citrus Heights. But anyway, I wanted to say that while I support this bill, I believe that within this politically polarizing time that we all live in, that we also need to protect people with disabilities. Now, that when it comes to adults with disabilities, obviously that we cannot necessarily put restrictions on adults like we can with children. But I just wanted to point out that we do need to make sure that we're protecting adults with disabilities, that when because I have multiple disabilities myself, we need to protect them as well. Thank you for the bill.
Yeah. No, Rick, thank you for that. And Dr. Jean Twenge, I wanted to go to you with that question. I mean, what about the research, you know, beyond young people, but, you know, other groups like Rick was mentioning, those with disabilities? What does the research say about that? What are your thoughts in response to his comment?
I mean, I don't know of any studies that have specifically looked at adults with disabilities and the links between their hours of social media use and depression. I do know that there have been several studies of adults that show very, very similar results to what we see with teens, that the more hours a day they spend on social media, the more likely they are to be depressed. And I think to, you know, put that in context, you know, we're, as, you know, the Assemblywoman put it, we're not talking about, you know, an hour or so of use a day, you know, connecting with the people who, you know, we have something common in common with online. We're talking about this heavy use, this excessive use, where particularly for children and teens who are still developing may have, you know, really negative effects.
And Jim, I wanted to ask you about what Common Sense, I know Common Sense Media has been a vocal advocate for children's online safety in general. And then with AB 56, focusing on the warning labels, are there additional legislative measures that you think might be needed to comprehensively address this problem? And if you wanted to also weigh in on Rick's question around, you know, this protecting other populations as well.
So yeah, I would say, first of all, Rebecca mentioned, look, we have a pretty good package together. We did the bill with Buffy Wicks on the age appropriate design code that Rebecca talked about. We wrote the California Consumer Privacy Act in 2017. That was like the really big, that's the biggest thing ever that we've done as a state and as Common Sense. And so I think Rebecca's right that there's a really good group of bills now. And the warning label is really going to sort of set the tone and explain to the public what happens. That's why I think it's a really simple thing. It's a public health measure. You've heard all the reasons why it's important. So I think what we're going to have is a really good package. But what we also have been doing, I'd say a few other things you're really going to see. One, we're going to do it in Europe. We'll do it probably over in Australia, and we'll do it in other states like New York. So when Rebecca mentioned a couple of the bills that Nancy Skinner passed and some of the other legislation that we've all worked on in the past 5 or 6 years, where we've really started to have big victories on the social media, just the regulation of tech front in the past 5 years or so, I think you're going to see that now move even more. And it'll go until the federal government gets its act together, which I don't count on. You'll see it at the state level and in Europe and Australia. So that's where I think the future is. And you're also going to start to see probably the big thing is financial penalties. And if we pass legislation where there are clear financial penalties for harms, then that's going to be a game changer too. And so I think the future is really bright and on the side of truth, justice, and mom and apple pie here. I really do.
All right. Well, if you're just joining us, this is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we're talking about California's new proposed legislation, AB 56, which aims to require warning labels on social media platforms about the mental health risks associated with those platforms for young people. And we're very pleased to be joined by Democratic Assembly Member Rebecca Bauer-Cahan from Orinda, who authored AB 56 and is advocating for its passage right now. We're also joined by Jim Steyer, founder and CEO of Common Sense Media, and Dr. Gene Twenge, psychologist and author of iGen. And we would love to hear from you. If you think warning labels on social media would change how young people use these platforms, you can dial in. The number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email your questions to us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Given the topic, I won't mention our social media handles, but Rebecca, I know we've got to leave in just a few minutes here. So I just wanted to ask a couple more questions for you before you leave early. We'll keep this conversation going with Jim and Dr. Twenge. So in terms of the prospects for this legislation moving forward, I asked you earlier about who's kind of lining up in support. Have you heard from any of the major tech companies yet to this legislation? And, you know, if not, what are the kinds of challenges that you're anticipating about trying to get this over the legislative finish line?
You know, I have served on the Privacy and Consumer Protection Committee for 6 years, which is the committee in the legislature that hears all of our tech policy. And there has yet to be a bill in the legislature that regulates our social media companies that they have not fiercely opposed. So I anticipate the same will be true here. But that shouldn't stop us. You know, this is an incredible bipartisan issue. 90% of Californians agree that we should be doing things like this to protect our kids from the harms of social media. And so we should absolutely forge ahead. And I'm confident that we will pass this bill, as Jim said, with bipartisan support and an overwhelming majority of my colleagues, you know, driving California's future toward one that is healthy for our children. That being said, you know, I think we will get pushback and we will overcome the arguments. I've heard that some believe this is a violation of the First Amendment. As a former law professor, and I have my, you know, partner here, Jim, who is also a law professor, both of us agree that this is absolutely not a violation of anyone's First Amendment rights. We have allowed these kind of public health warnings on products for as long as I can remember, and as long as they are based in the science, they're absolutely permissible and allowed under the Constitution. So, you know, they can come at us, but we will continue to do what we must do to protect our kids.
And Rebecca, on the question of potential legal challenges, you just talked about the potential First Amendment ones. Are there limits to what a state can do? Is there federal legislation here? And if not, what kind of federal legislation would you want to see?
So, you know, the federal legislation, Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, says that the social media companies cannot be held to account for what other people post on their platforms. And that has been really challenging. We are preempted from doing anything to impact that. And so that actually has been the biggest challenge around protecting our kids online. And I say every chance I get, I am so hopeful that one day Congress will actually change that, because it has allowed these companies to get away with harming our kids day in and day out. And states have been left with very few tools to help protect our communities. And so, you know, that's my concern about the federal legislation that is in place. It does not affect this, because this is not about what other people are posting, right? This is us asking them to put out a warning. It does not deal with the content that other people are putting onto their platforms. And so it is not barred by Section 230. And so it is one of the avenues that we are using as a result of those limitations on our ability to protect kids.
All right. Well, that's good to know some of the legal landscape here and the need for potentially some federal legislation. And also, I just got word that sounds like, Rebecca, you're able to stay on for a few more minutes, which is great. I do want to go to an email question we got in. Robin in San Francisco writes, what role should parents play alongside legislation like AB 56 in helping young people navigate social media responsibly? Gene, let me direct that one to you. What do you say to parents?
Yeah, so great question. I'm actually working on a book right now called Future Proof Parenting about kids in tech, because this is so front of mind for so many parents. And I have three adolescent children myself. So the tough part is it is really hard for parents to try to regulate their kids' social media use, because parental permission is required and age isn't verified. So parents kind of have their hands tied. So I don't ever want to be read as saying that, you know, where are the parents? And it all has to be up to the parents, because we have to acknowledge how hard this is. With that said, there are things that you can do. So yes, obviously talk to your kids about this issue. You know, if we get this bill passed and these warning labels are out there, that'll be really good ammunition for parents to be able to point to that. Just like they say it, as I did to my 15-year-old the other day, wear your seatbelt. You know, it's the law. This isn't quite the law, but at least we'd have a warning label where something was going to back us up. And I think we have to realize, you know, the warning label, it's necessary but not sufficient. There are definitely still, more to be done in this area. But as parents, we not only need to have that conversation with our kids, but we have to try to do things to make sure, like, for example, that our 10-year-olds are not on Instagram or TikTok, because the companies aren't doing it for us and the law's not being enforced on that. You're supposed to be 13. So I think the somewhat reluctant conclusion I have come to in writing this book is it's going to have to be things like using third-party parental control software, because the parental controls that are built into devices are okay, but kind of hard to use and not very comprehensive.
And Jim Steyer, let me go to you. Have there been any similar laws in other states or countries? What lessons could California learn from what's happening outside of our borders?
You mean in terms of warning label?
In terms of warning labels, yeah, this general issue of trying to basically alert people to the harms.
So here's what I'd say. Yes. And I think Rebecca or Gene said it earlier. You have the smoking example and alcohol. I mean, there's dramatic shift in underage smoking and cigarette use in general because of the public awareness campaigns and the warning labels. That's the obvious thing. That's why I compared it to a tobacco moment earlier. So yeah, you see major public health victories. You saw it with also a designated driver campaign. You've seen a bunch of like public health, really effective campaigns that Common Sense Media has actually been involved in. So I think that we have examples of fundamental behavior change because of these public awareness campaigns, if they're really strategic. And this is simple, easy to understand, plenty of predicates. It'll be great. And I think, as Gene was talking about, look, parents need to be able to have this conversation with their kids on an ongoing basis. We're all parents. I've got four kids. We're all of us on the phone. Think about this in light of our own kids. And you have to create a safe space for regular conversations about their lives, both on and offline, I think, and build trust with them and be able to talk. So I actually think, I completely believe we have to regulate these guys. I completely believe this is a very good law that will have many, many benefits. But at the same time, there's a lot of roles for parents here. And it is sort of an ongoing healthy dialogue and listening to their experiences on social media and what do they deal with on it, and encouraging healthy habits and then modeling those. Because a lot, we're all, as I said, we're all parents here. And we know that our kids learn from us. And as Rebecca said, she grew up in a very different era. We all did, where we didn't grow up with this stuff, thank God. But I do think that there's a really big role parents can play. That's the, we have 150 million users of Common Sense Media. So we got a lot of parents out there who listen. So I think this warning label is going to be a very positive thing to help families have discussions. And I think kids are smart too. They know these issues. They know about their own mental health issues and all their peers' mental health issues. So I think this is just going to capsulize a lot of really good stuff. And I'm, Gene, I'm glad to hear you're writing a new book, because I think the public wants to hear this.
Well, and Gene, just to turn to you on that, are there other examples that California could be pulling from what's happening around the world that you think are particularly instructive for the state here?
Well, I got to tell you my favorite from one of my favorite countries in the world, which is Australia, which just passed a law raising the minimum age for social media to 16 and requiring age to be verified. So I went to Australia twice this fall. The second time was specifically to present at a conference discussing some of the research and policy in this area. So I was very excited to see that pass. I think Australia is leading the world in this area. So it's really encouraging. I think it may be true. Who knows if we'll get that done, you know, at the federal level here in the US, but try to do it state by state. The problem is, pretty much the minute it gets passed, the social media companies challenge it in court. So Florida, for example, has a bill that doesn't even go as far as Australia's, and it's being challenged in the court. So that's what happens. The companies have made so much money that they can pay really good lawyers.
Yeah. Well, we just have time for one more question. We're just about out of time. Assemblymember Bauer Cahan, last question to you is, well, first of all, I'm curious if you've been drawing inspiration and networking with others outside of California's borders, but also how can people get involved? What are the sort of next steps with this legislation?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. You know, we do have incredible working groups where we work across state lines in a bipartisan way to figure out how to legislate in these areas in a way that's consistent, that works, and also that protects our communities. And so, you know, I invite people to get involved and to advocate for these types of policies. You know, I appreciated the question about what parents can do, because we obviously have a role in raising our children and making sure they understand how to use these products responsibly. But at our press conference where we unveiled this bill, we heard from the mother of a young girl from Marin, whose name was Alexander, who died by suicide just 4 months ago, very much driven into depression and suicide ideation by social media. And, you know, her mother said in her remarks, and it really stuck with me, I did everything I thought was right. And so I know the parents out there are trying. They know that their kids need their protection. And I just want them to know that the government is doing everything we can to have their backs, because our kids deserve to be happy. We shouldn't have book titles like Dr. Twang's where kids are less happy. They deserve a happy, healthy future. And we are working to give it to them. And we are your partners in ensuring that. So thank you.
Well, absolutely. Just underscores the importance of the work that all of you are doing. And we really just scratched the surface, but I want to thank you all for joining us. This is Dr. Gene Twenge, a psychologist and author of several books, including iGen, Jim Steyer, Stanford professor, author and founder and CEO of Common Sense Media, and Assemblymember Rebecca Bauer Cahan from Arinda and the author of AB 56. Thank you all three of you so much for joining us on State of the Bay.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
And I also want to just remind listeners that we are in the midst of our December membership drive. If you listen to KALW and have never become a member, please consider joining KALW right now. You can decide the amount you want to give at any level. You'll be making a difference, changing your relationship to the resource that you value. We hope you value here at KALW. Well, coming up next, we're going to hear the latest on Oakland's leadership challenges and budget crisis. So stay with us.
Hey, I'm One Way Possible. Every weeknight, I supply your soundtrack of forgotten favorites, future favorites, and all the journeys in between, so you can discover music you may not hear anywhere else. We couldn't do any of it without you. We truly are listener-supported public radio, and we are here for you. So go to kalw.org and click that donate button. Thank you for being there for us.
This is State of the Bay on local public radio, KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Ethan Elkind, and now we're going to turn our attention to Oakland, where the aftermath of November's election is rippling through the community. Voters have recalled both the Oakland Mayor Sheng Tao and the Alameda County District Attorney amid mounting frustrations over public safety and governance. And on top of that, the city of Oakland also faces a budget crisis, rampant crime, homelessness, and an affordable housing shortage, which is leaving many to wonder how this new leadership is going to address all of these critical challenges. So tonight, we'll learn who is or may be throwing their hat into the mayoral race. We're also going to explore what Oakland's financial challenges may mean for the future of the city and the people who live in Oakland. Joining us today to unpack these issues, we're very pleased to be joined by Shomik Mukherjee, reporter from the Bay Area News Group. Shomik's coverage includes Oakland with a focus on local politics. Welcome to State of the Bay, Shomik.
Very kind of you to have me on. Thanks.
No, very glad that you are with us, and there's a lot to talk about, as I mentioned in the intro. So let's first just start, though, with Oakland's mayoral turmoil. So as I mentioned, Oakland Mayor Sheng Tao was recalled in November. She's the first mayor to be recalled in the city's history. She's going to leave office just about 2 years into her term. Shomik, can you give us a little bit of background? How did we get here? What were some of the reasons that Mayor Tao lost the confidence of Oakland residents?
Yeah, Oakland has been kind of through a remarkable 4 or 5 year stretch of difficulties that seemed to kind of crest in 2023, right after Mayor Tao took office. And she encountered, I think it's safe to say, both challenges that were unforeseen and struggles that perhaps were avoidable. Right after she came on, there was an internal affairs scandal in the Oakland Police Department that led her to fire the police chief at the time, Laron Armstrong, largely over his response to the scandal. That earned her quite a bit of ire, including from the NAACP chapter here in Oakland. And it's been a feud that she's never really been able to resolve. In 23, there were a lot of businesses that closed and their closures were attributed to crime. Crime got worse in 23, and it was part of this sort of era of the pandemic where things got worse in all the big cities in the country. But in Oakland, they didn't seem to level off really at the same rate as the other cities. The A's, after kind of a long back and forth, decided to leave Oakland in 23. There's a historic budget deficit for which the realities really took shape after federal COVID relief dollars went away. Some of these problems seem to maybe dissipate in severity since the start of this year, which allowed the mayor to point to the recall effort against her as sort of the product of this very organized right-wing and moderate effort to kind of boot her from office. A lot of the recall campaign's signature gathering phase was bankrolled entirely by a man named Philip Dreyfus, who's a hedge fund executive living in Piedmont. And that kind of supplied the mayor fodder to sort of point to this as something that was happening outside of town and invading Oakland in some ways politically. But then things went really south over the summer when the mayor announced that her solution to kind of combating this really bad budget deficit was the city's sale of its share of the Coliseum, a sale for whose details are still being kind of figured out and for which the money still needs to come through. And then the other kind of big elephant in the room that became national news and led to this perception that there was a distrust in her leadership was this sprawling federal criminal inquiry in Oakland that started on June 20th with these FBI raids that hit the mayor's home for reasons we don't entirely understand still.
Yeah, I know. Well, I appreciate you running through the litany of stuff here. There's a lot going on in just those 2 short years with Mayor Sheng Tao, outgoing Mayor Sheng Tao. So what happens next for Oakland? What are the mechanics here? This is the first recall, as I said, in the history of Oakland. Who's going to be taking the reins? When is there going to be another election? What's the process going forward?
Yeah, it's a very timely question. The city council tomorrow is going to approve the certified election results in Alameda County, at which point the mayor will be expected to leave office. And then this sort of carousel begins where the council president, Nikki Fortunato-Voss, is going to serve as interim mayor for just a few weeks because she's just been elected Alameda County supervisor. When she leaves office, then the newly shaped city council, which will have include members elected in last month's election in November, will select a new president who will serve both as an interim mayor and the council president in tandem. And but mainly focus really on being the mayor, only vote on the council when it comes to when there's a tie that needs to be broken. And then we're right back into election mode. There's going to be an election on April 15th, a special election to find a new mayor and to fill the vacancy left behind by Councilmember Boss. The candidate filing period for that is just about to begin, and
Who's throwing their names into the hat there? Do we know who the candidates might be?
Yeah, it's funny. Special elections are always just kind of weird where you have all kinds of names being suggested. I know even before the November election took place, there was this big kind of news story that made the rounds of Marshawn Lynch kind of floating.
Seattle Seahawks running back and Cal running back, right?
Yeah, beast mode, as many know him, floating his name. Since since Mayor Tao was actually recalled by voters in the November election, names have seriously begun to emerge, including former city council president Ignacio de la Fuente, who ran unsuccessfully for mayor in 2022. Lauren Taylor, the candidate who lost to Mayor Tao, in sort of a really breakneck first place, second place finish in 22, has declared his candidacy for a while. And notably, he's the only person who has so far said he won't drop out of the race if a candidate like Barbara Lee, the kind of historic and iconic East Bay Congresswoman, were to run after she retires from Congress. Mm-hmm. That run from Barbara Lee, that the idea that she would run is kind of almost making the early candidacy announcements sort of a formality, because there are candidates like De La Fuente, another candidate and a lobbyist named Isaac Koss-Reed, who have said they would drop out immediately if Barbara Lee were to run the pro-labor.
She would clear the field.
Exactly.
Or a lot of the field. Yeah. Well, I want to let listeners know, if you're just joining us, this is State of the Bay on local public radio, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Ethan Elkind. We're discussing City of Oakland and its mayoral recall and those implications. Also, we're going to talk about Oakland's budget crisis. We'd love to hear from you as well. Do you live in Oakland and have thoughts about what's going on or maybe going wrong in the city? You can call us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or email us with any questions you have at stateofthebay@kalw.org. We're very pleased to be joined by Shomik Mukherjee, reporter from the Bay Area News Group. Shomik's coverage includes Oakland with a focus on local politics. Well, Shomik, I know we've got just a few minutes left, and I do want to ask you about the budget crisis. So whoever's going to be elected, they're going to inherit a huge deficit, nearly $130 million by the close of the fiscal year. So how did Oakland get into this situation, and what are some of the options being bandied about to try to fix this?
Yeah, it's funny we're talking about a mayoral election for someone who's going to serve for a year and a half and have to address the structural deficit that's going on. No matter who you ask, people kind of depict this election as you'd have to be sort of crazy to want to be the mayor of Oakland this summer, because this historic deficit, which now at the moment is projected to be $130 million by the end of this fiscal year, is really, really at Oakland's doorstep, to the point where officials are now projecting that they would have to make somewhere in the vicinity of 91 layoffs between now and early next year, in addition to making all sorts of cuts to police academies, fire stations, and cultural funding for arts, to get back on track. You asked how this started. it seems like, at least according to the people that the city hired to assess the budget situation, that Oakland has been spending more than it takes brings in for a while now. This was papered over in some ways by the pandemic when federal dollars were pouring in. But what happened is during the pandemic, housing interests sort of housing prices sort of spiked, and then after the Fed increased their interest rates, housing prices plummeted. The city taxes any transfers of real estate, and the revenue from that tax really, really steeply plummeted after those interest rates went up. In the meantime, the police department has sort of outspent its budget year after year by paying its officers overtime, and they say that they need to do that because there aren't enough people wanting to become cops in Oakland, and they're losing people through attrition. They're probably going to lose a lot more, though. None of these layoffs are actually going to affect sworn police officers. The cuts of the department are going to be for non-sworn staff, and as well as public work staff. I think that's the biggest department hit, and more across the board.
So, Shomik, when are we going to learn more about how this budget crisis is going to be resolved? What are some sort of the next steps here?
Well, it's really in flux right now. The council has its last meeting of the year tomorrow. The newly shaped city council will vote in January about whether to put a sales tax on the ballot, which would kind of start bringing in additional revenue streams to Oakland next year. But sometime before the close of the fiscal year, which happens in June, the city council needs to make a bevy of cuts in order to get back on track. And the Coliseum sale, which I mentioned earlier, the city's expecting to receive in total $125 million from the sale of its share of the Coliseum. That's still pending, but they are no longer budgeting those dollars at the behest of their finance department staff. They're hoping instead that that money can come in sometime before the close of the fiscal year. And that's kind of a fingers crossed situation. But beyond that, Oakland's in a really, really tricky situation where what's the correct path forward is something that's in flux day to day.
Man, so much uncertainty. I mean, I think that proposed sale is a microcosm of all the uncertainty swirling around Oakland. Well, we're unfortunately out of time, but I just want to thank you for walking us through what's the latest on Oakland's budget issues and mayoral challenges. Shomik Mukherjee, reporter with the Bay Area News Group, thank you for joining us here at State of the Bay.
Thanks so much.
And I also want to thank our listener, Alan Perlman, for supporting KALW and State of the Bay. When you become a member of KALW, you are truly helping produce the radio that you love. The vast majority of our budget goes to producing and acquiring programming. So when you join KALW, you're becoming an active participant in one of the most creative and productive stations in public radio. And you can become a member by going to kalw.org/donate. Or go ahead and call 1-800-525-9917 right now to become a member to support this station. We greatly appreciate your support for the radio that we put on here at KALW. Now, coming up after this short break, we're going to hear a preview of the Great Dickens Christmas Fair. So stay tuned.
The gift of songs. Give the gift of songs, stories, melodies, and rhythms. When you donate to KALW, you are giving to all your fellow listeners and to yourself as well. If music matters to you, please donate now at KALW.org, and thank you.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. During the Christmas season, something magical happens in Daly City. The Cow Palace is transformed into the bustling streets of Victorian England, where guests can wander into dance halls, theaters, and shops while meeting and mingling with the characters of Charles Dickens' London. It's part immersive theater and part craft festival. The Dickens Fair has been entertaining Bay Area residents for the last 40 years. And here to tell us about the fair are CEO Kevin Patterson and actor Shelby Bond. So Kevin and Shelby, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thank you.
Shelby, let me start with you. And I understand you are Sherlock Holmes here, otherwise known as Sherlock Holmes for the purpose of the fair. Can you introduce us to the Dickens Fair? What does it feel like to walk the streets of Dickens London?
Dickens Fair feels like walking into another world. And that's what I was immediately drawn to, because you are completely immersed in the literature and the people of Victorian London. And no matter what time it is outdoors, when you walk in, it's always like 8 p.m. on Christmas Eve. So I get to live in that in Christmas Eve for Christmas Day for 5 weeks. It's wonderful.
Huh. And Kevin, what's the origin story of the Dickens Fair? I understand it's a family affair.
Yeah, thank you very much. My mother and father, Ron and Phyllis Patterson, invented the Renaissance Pleasure Fair concept in America. And it was first held in Southern California and then in the San Francisco Bay Area in the 60s. And in 1970, they decided to branch out and to embrace Victorian England, San Francisco being a very Victorian era city. And they rented a warehouse down by the Embarcadero, and they filled it with all of the things that you would find in a Victorian marketplace, including the vaudevillians and including the music hall performers singing bawdy songs, and of course a great dance floor where people can waltz. And they brought with that the ethic of people participating. So it wasn't so much a theatrical production that people could sit and watch, as one that they could actually take part in and learn the dances and play around with the accents and wear a top hat or a bonnet. And it became so much fun, and it became such a tradition in the Bay Area that now, 40 seasons later, even after surviving an earthquake and having to relocate to the Cow Palace, where we've been now for 23 years, it has grown in popularity and in the joy that it creates, the way that people have found a spark for their holiday enthusiasm every year by coming to the Dickens Christmas Fair. It's very heartwarming.
Yeah. Well, Kevin, what kind of people attend? Can you give us a picture of the kind of typical or maybe atypical attendee at the fair?
I don't think you can. I think it is all walks of life and all people who enjoy gathering together with their families and their friends and to be able to shop, as you mentioned, in these beautiful handcraft shops, and also to meet theater people in their sort of moment of being actually becoming the characters. There's over 300 characters from out of Dickens novels and the time period of Charles Dickens London that you can meet. So you go there from any walk of life, and you find people from the strata of Victorian London, from the merchants right on through to the sailors singing sea shanties, and it's just really very inviting for absolutely everyone.
And Shelby Bond, I understand that you drive up from LA every weekend to do the show, so this certainly must be a labor of love for you. How did you get involved with the fair?
I go all the way from Los Angeles to London every weekend. I can just do that in San Francisco. You mentioned the audience, and I was going to say I've seen the audience change a lot. I've been there over 20 years, and there's a really amazing young generation of people that are into cosplay and Comic-Cons, things like that, that are coming out and want to fully dress up and be immersed in this new environment that, you know, it's so it's not just, you know, older people or full families. You've got groups of kids that are just like diving into the world of Dickens and Oliver Twist and Edgar Allan Poe, and just loving the streets of London. And I love to see that it's become really diverse with all sorts of ages and people. Go ahead.
Yeah, please continue.
Yeah, I wanted to throw in that it is like being in London's West End with all of the theater doors thrown open for free, and you can wander through and really just be immersed in what it was like to be in London during Christmas Eve, and sit down in a theater as well as wander through the streets.
Shelby, as I mentioned, you play Sherlock Holmes, and I wanted to ask from your perspective as an actor, How does it work? First of all, did you have to audition? Do actors have to audition for these roles? Did you have to audition? And are there scripts? Are you improvising? How does it work being an actor at the fair?
I think there are, after 40 years of the Dickens Fair, there are all these wonderful levels that things operate on out there. It kind of runs like a little city in its own. And I proposed, after I went away and lived in London for a couple of years and trained in immersive theater, I came back and I proposed doing something different, which would be a puzzle game, kind of like a deconstructed escape room throughout the Dickens Fair. And so when people come to Baker Street and see Sherlock Holmes, they're given a case and they get to go out kind of collecting clues and solving puzzles. So I say, if people love puzzles, they're going to love what I'm doing. If they're lukewarm on puzzles, they should go see a show.
So Kevin, I want to ask you, what specifically makes it a Dickensian fair?
Well, the traditions of Christmas that we all kind of take for granted, that we know and love from our childhood, right on through. The Christmas tree, for instance, is a Victorian construction. That is something that the British, because of this love affair between Prince Albert and Queen Victoria, and him being German, adopted. So the Christmas tree came to England in the Victorian era. And that really is just the beginning of it, because when you think about what makes Christmas in our traditional around the fireplace, warm celebration, it is the story of A Christmas Carol. And what Charles Dickens did that was so special is he took the human spirit and encapsulated it in this person called Ebenezer Scrooge at a time period in, the year when maybe we're all thinking about business and we're all thinking about conflict and we're thinking about the things in our lives that aren't the way we want them to be. And then the holidays roll around. And just like with Ebenezer Scrooge, you learn how to reconnect with your heart. And the story of A Christmas Carol is that of the redemption of the human heart. Mm-hmm. So we bring to life these traditions and this story all around you. And it is truly what the Victorian mind of Charles Dickens constructed and articulated. And you get to live that when you come to the Dickens Fair. And that's why we're so at home in the Victorian era, we feel.
Yeah, well, I love that description. And Shelby, if it's okay, I want to interview you as Sherlock Holmes for a minute. And if that's okay, I'm curious, Sherlock, Mr. Holmes, what your favorite establishments? What are your favorite establishments to visit at the fair?
I love at the Dickens Fair London that when you enter, you are entering right by Fezziwig's dance hall, so you can do the waltz. It can be lovely and very high class. And as you move through the streets of London, you may move to the docks. You may move to Mad Sal's music hall, where you see scandalous things like the can-can dance all the way from France. Of course, it may be too much for you, and you may have to move over to the other side where there are children's affairs and Father Christmas. But I love that moving through the streets of Victorian Dickensian fair feels like Dickensian London itself, that it has different areas which impart different parts of the holiday magic to you.
Oh, just wonderful. Wonderful. I love the way you just transport, even just hearing your voice, it just transports us to a totally different place. Amazing to think that this is just down in Daly City at the Cow Palace. We're just about out of time. Kevin, for those listening, when is the Dickens Fair open? How can somebody procure a ticket to this fine fair?
Well, it's all made very clear on dickensfair.com. If you go there, not only do you have the answer to the question that you just asked, which is that you only have one more weekend to attend. The fair is just concluding its 40th Ruby Jubilee anniversary season. So get your tickets now because they are likely to sell out. And then plan your visit by using the information on the website, and do join the email list so that you can be alerted early next year and maybe plan to come a couple of times.
Well, it sounds wonderful. And we will also include a link on our State of the Bay page on KALW.org. So you heard it here. Go see the Dickens Fair and enjoy life in Dickensian London. I want to thank CEO Kevin Patterson and actor Shelby Bond. Thank you both so much for joining us on State of the Bay tonight.
My pleasure.
Happy holidays. Happy Christmas.
Happy holidays to you both. Well, that's State of the Bay for this week. We want to thank all of our guests and listeners for being part of the conversation. Next Monday at 6, we'll be rebroadcasting a few of our favorite interviews, but we'll be back with you live in 2025. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, you can visit our website on kalw.org. And if you have any questions or comments, email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Tonight's show was produced by Kendra Klang and Jillian Emblad. It was engineered by David Kwan, and D Minor was our board operator. I'm Ethan Elkind. Good night. Thanks for listening, and happy holidays.